Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for joining. Hope everyone's doing okay. And welcome to the last class in our series on religious Zionism, what it means and why it matters. And I guess you could say I saved the best for last, not in the sense of my own performance in delivering this year, but more in the sense of the topic at hand itself. I think it's a really important one and an interesting one. And I think it's also one that continues to evolve and develop as time goes on. From the inception of the state until today. And the topic at hand is a statewide And essentially, the question is as follows. We are all used to questions in halacha that relate to our own personal religious observance, and specifically in regard to Shabbat. There's a literature, a lot of literature in the Gemara. And later sources about how to keep Shabbat and what to do in specific situations where keeping Shabbat is challenging. We're probably all familiar with the notion that pikuach nefesh docheh Shabbat, that when situations are life-threatening, you are allowed to violate Shabbat to save lives. And there are all sorts of interesting questions that relate to that, such as, what's considered life-threatening? What if you're not sure if it's life-threatening? What if you don't do something now, it'll be life-threatening later? And those are all really interesting questions, but they're all related to the individual. The question becomes my individual Shabbat, my individual Sabbath observance. How do I go about doing it? And what happens when there's a conflict between my personal Sabbath observance and somebody else's life or my own life? But with the inception, with the founding of the State of Israel, you have a whole new series of questions that really, for thousands of years, were never really thought about because they simply weren't relevant. And the question of how a state, a government, an entire people should function on Shabbat. What does it mean for a state to keep Shabbat? What does it mean for a government to try to observe the Shabbat? What about questions like national security on Shabbat or electricity for an entire country on Shabbat or even the economy? All of these questions, you wouldn't, if the person who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Karo, if you would have asked him, what the Jewish state should do on Shabbat, he'd look at you like you were crazy. Like, what, the government, we don't take care of that stuff. That's for the Sultan, that's for the king, that's for the queen, that's for whatever, wherever we live, they take care of that. We just have to worry about in our community what we do. And these are all sorts of new questions that develop. And what I'd like to show is that that's part of also, beyond the theological questions of what the state of Israel means to us, what returning back to the land of Israel means to us, beyond the theological questions of dealing with, different challenges in selling the land of Israel, is a very practical question and the endeavor to figure out, on the one hand, what I'm going to argue, the bridge between the idealism and realism. How do we take the ideal of halacha and Shabbat and apply it to the actual practical real world of life in the state of Israel today? And so that's some of the questions that I'd like to begin to address. And I hope that we're not, let me be very clear on two things. Number one, we're certainly not going to address all the issues. I mean, that would take years and years, and it's still developing. But what I hope to do is plant at least a few thoughts in your mind to consider. And maybe some frame some of the basic issues. With that, I'm going to share my PowerPoint. And we will begin. So here we have the city of Jerusalem as the sun sets down. This is my title page. How do we go about observing a statewide Shabbat? So let me just be clear that much of the material today is not my own. It's from a rabbi named Rabbi Yisrael Rosen, an article he wrote. Yisrael Rosen was a very prominent name in the religious Zionist world. He was the founder of Machon Somet. Have you anyone here heard of Machon Somet? Maybe you can raise your hand. Machon Somet is the Institute for the Interface of Halacha and Technology. They're responsible for all sorts of new technology that aids people in the observance of Shabbat, things like you know, proper Shabbat elevators, and so that they, those can work appropriately. Things like lights that you can use, for instance, if you're in sort of a tough situation, you don't have candles to light. And really, it goes on and on. Phones that first responders could use in the event they need to use their phone on Shabbos, but they want to limit the Shabbos secretion involved. So that's Rabbi Yisrael Rosen. He wrote a really important article that we're going to reference today. So this is your Israel. Here's the problem. And I think we can all consider the problem, right? The notion of a nation, of a state observing Shabbat is incredibly complicated because so many of the things that a state needs to do every single day certainly require desecration of Shabbat. You just like begin to think about it, right? Like even something like the water system, like the things like to make sure people have running water, that can involve all sorts of Shabbos desecration, even just that basic necessity. So he writes as follows. When we raise the issue of the Sabbath, the national face, the functioning of the Jewish state, we're faced with a mountain of questions our fathers never considered. That's actually a reference from a pasuk in the Tochacha in the rebuke to the Jewish people. They say, Lo se'arim avotechem. We never thought of such questions. Since our exile from our country, there has been no Jewish society with political dependent sovereign rule. We haven't had this. You are not required to operate an army, police, a fire brigade, intelligence agencies, embassies, prisons, hospitals, first aid, power plants, water supply, communications, and on and on and on. Under the responsibility of government authorities. This was never our job. We never had to think about this stuff. And so these questions were never really addressed. It's a whole new terrain, a new territory that's sort of uncharted. And that's what makes it so interesting. So before we go on to see a few approaches, we're going to study to begin this year a very bitter dispute between two different thinkers. But I'd like to hear some of your thoughts. Just based on what you know, your impressions, how would you begin to sort of think about these questions? Like, let's take something simple or as basic as security. National security, things like policemen. Policemen need to drive from place to place to do patrols. And policemen need to sort of, you know, survey the traffic. And if there's an accident, they need to be there. And if people are speeding, that's what policemen do. And if there's somebody calls for a crime, they need to go there. So if I were to ask you, how would you go about considering whether such a thing should operate on Shabbat? What would you say? And what complications might there be?
They have to operate.
Okay, good. Why?
Well, first of all, I can tell you from personal experience in Israel, in Ramot, where my kids live, Ramot Bet, the shul that we went to, the members of the shul who had all served in the Tzahal and everything in various capacities, they took turns standing at the gate, armed with their Uzis or whatever they were carrying, plus all these phones that they had to in case there was an emergency. And these are all Shomer Shabbos guys with kippot right. And tzitzis hanging out. So, I mean, obviously, certain things supersede the protection of the people, the health of the people, supersedes the observance of the law the way we know it, as far as I can understand.
Right. So that's a great point, and I totally agree with everything you say, but that I think everybody can agree to, right? Because why are they standing guard there in front of the synagogue? Sorry, Paul?
But we have precedent. There right. were these things that required to be done before the state of Israel was formed.
100%.
So as a lawyer, I believe in precedent. So why don't we look at how this issue was handled before the state of Israel was born, starting from day one? I mean, when we had the temples, surely they had guards standing outside the temples and saying, you can come in, you can't come in. You haven't paid your dues, you can't come in. You know. There were guys doing that then, so why not look at precedent?
I agree with you 100%, and we should, and we will. That's what we need to do. I think Leona's case is a good one because it's very basic, right? There, that's clearly pikuach nefesh in the sense that security, if we're afraid that someone might go into the shul and start hurting people, that certainly necessitates carrying a gun. Plus, carrying a gun in and of itself, what Shabbos desecration then involves is an interesting question. But that I don't want to get to. But what about something like this, right? You know, How about, let's say, a police officer notes that someone ran a red light on Shabbat. Can they go get them a ticket? Can they drive there to get them a ticket?
It might be saving his life.
Might be saving his life. Okay. So we can argue.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean,
what about the there are so ticket? Few in Yerushalayim, there's so few cars on Shabbos.
That's true. That's true. So I'm not going to go through all the cases now. And I can't, obviously, but just to think about some of the complications here, right? So we can address on two levels. On the individual level, very hard to argue. So even if you're going to argue that we have to stop people from speeding because that won't make people's lives, which is a good argument, what about printing the ticket? You're going to really tell me that if I don't print the ticket right now, people are going to die because of that? Hard argument. But then maybe on the national level. What about on the national level? If people generally, Paul, you're saying a lot, but I don't hear you because of the defense. But on the national level, if we think about that, and what if the whole country knows that on Shabbat there are no tickets? Well, then that's sort of a different argument. So it's just a totally new arena of halacha to consider.
But so what about if you're, from the army's point of view, going to say that it's okay to attack the enemy every day of the week except Shabbos? No point, right? Shabbos, why do all those malachot on Shabbos when you can do them during the week? So don't attack on Shabbos.
I don't know. So that's an interesting question. Can we afford to wait? When do we have to attack? And why do we have to attack now? So these are all questions I want to briefly get to.
But not every policeman is Shomer Shabbos. So why don't you start with
the people? Okay, so that's another point.
Why don't you start with the people who can and then work your way down? And you may not even reach the bottom of the Shomer Shabbos guy.
Okay. So Paul says, let's rely on the people, essentially, who are not Shomer Shabbos. Okay.
Pay him a bonus for working on Saturday.
I hear you.
Time and a half.
Okay, so that's an interesting point. So those are all relevant points. Let's take a look at the following. And he says the problem is as follows. And let's, right? What is it? Let's just read a little bit more from Rabbi Rosen, and then we'll see a really, really loaded, charged debate about this. So here it's as follows. All these functions and many more cannot be completely disabled on Shabbat. Considerable parts of them must operate on Shabbat through the direct or indirect affiliation with the saving of lives, or public safety and of its property. As well known, halacha is built on many precedents, but in these public and state issues, everything is new and no halachic way has been paved since time immemorial. They ask the following questions. Should a Jewish state rely on Gentiles to operate the systems on Shabbat? So on the one hand, we do have a notion that, you know, even though generally relying on Gentiles to do halacha for us is not permissible, but it's certainly less strict than, you know, Jewish people doing the malacha directly. Gentiles don't have to keep Shabbat themselves. So maybe that's a way of looking at it. But then you could argue, but do we really want to do that? The only way to function is to rely on Gentiles? Do you rely on secular Jews to make a Shabbat a weekday, right? Do we say, okay, you don't keep Shabbat anyway, so you'll do it? Well, that's also, you know, on the one hand, okay, but are we saying, and I think let's skip to the other last question here. Most importantly, there's a poignant question of faith here related to the essence of the concept of a living Torah. Is our Torah not applicable in certain circumstances? Is it individual theory and not a public theory? Can it be there's no solution to these issues that we have to rely on sort of these, you know, difficult solutions which are not ideal? How do we reconcile this? So here I want to present to you there's a very charged debate here that takes place in between two very prominent figures, Dr. Yeshayahu Leibowitz. Maybe you've heard of him. He was a very well-known public intellectual, a professor in Hebrew University in biology and other sciences. I would say he definitely orthodox in practice. We'll see today whether we can identify him as orthodox in terms of his belief system, but he's a very well-known person. And then we had Rabbi Moshe Tzvi Neria, who was, you could say, almost the father of he's called the father of the Kippot Srugot, in a sense, the father of the B'nai Akiva movements, for sure. A very important religious Zionist thinker.
I know his son.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Very cool.
I am there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very prominent family in Israel.
Yeah.
So I like to study, they had an exchange in 1951, which is just 3 years after the founding of the state, about Shabbat and the state. And we'll begin with Yeshayahu Leibowitz. And let me just preface that I don't agree with his conclusions, at all, personally. I mean, look, everyone's entitled to their opinion. I think the problems he raises are significant ones, and they're ones that need to be addressed and thought about. And I think it's interesting to study what he says, at least in terms of a way of framing our thinking. So this is Rabbi Rosen, Yisrael Rosen's summary of his conclusions from an article that he wrote, he publicized, which was called Shabbat in the State as a Religious Problem. He looks at Shabbat in the State of Israel as a problem. This is a dilemma. We have trouble with this. That's his perspective. And these are seven essential points he makes. Shabbat is a religious problem in the absence of halachic solutions to the functioning of a Jewish state. Well, that I think we can agree. If we can't function, this is an issue. Religious Judaism and its rabbis, and here he's accusatory, have not presented a realistic Shabbat constitution. They haven't actually presented a practical halachic way of observing Shabbat in the State of Israel and are only devoting efforts to exempting Sabbath keepers from the obligation to work and imposing the burden on secularists only. So essentially, to the suggestion that, oh, we'll just get the people who don't keep Shabbat to do it, Yishai Leibowitz says, you are ignoring the problem. You are not solving the problem. You can't tell me have them do it because they're saying they're not keeping halacha. That's not a solution. That's avoiding the problem. And he says, he mentions about a few issues here. The problematic issues include the area of homeland security, water, electricity, and shipping and heavy industry. Okay. And he says, what about maybe some of the different solutions that you might suggest, you know, as you sort of patch the problems here? He says they're not good enough. Relying on a Gentile as a Sabbath Gentile, right, is we call a Shabbos guy, is a term commonly used, is not acceptable nowadays from a religious educational point of view. If people look at religious Jews and say the only way that they can function is if they get the non-Jews to do it, that's not good from a religious educational point. That doesn't represent the halachic Jew well at all. If the only way we can function is as a state, for the basic necessities of the state is to ask non-Jews to do it. And he says, scientific, and this will challenge, obviously, scientific and technical solutions seem to have little or no chance. It's not going to be enough. Whatever technology we develop, he says, is not going to be enough. Any method seeking permits, just as deviations, what we call shinoi, are improper and alienate the youth. Essentially, his point is, so what are you going to do? You're going to say, okay, so look, you got to use your phone on Shabbos, but we'll make a certain type of phone that you're going to use in an abnormal way, which sort of mitigates the problem so it's not so bad, right? You know, or you have to, I don't know, you have to push a button and push it with your elbow. And if you push it with your elbow, that's not quite as bad. It's an abnormal way to do it. He says people don't appreciate that as a solution. They think, okay, you really couldn't come up with a solution. And finally, and here's this conclusion. I mean, you could agree or disagree with 1 through 6. We'll address all of them. But number 7 is the big conclusion. The functioning of the state on Shabbat should be extensively permitted, similar to a work permit in the temple. What he says is we need to come to the conclusion that generally, that for the state to function, that supersedes Malach on Shabbat. That's what we have to come. We have to come to this conclusion that, look, apparently now we have a state and the state must function on Shabbat. And that's just the way it has to be. And that must be halachically permissible.
Rabbi,
let's read through his words. And I want to get your reaction. Just let's read some of them directly. Okay. Rabbi. First, here's the attack. I'll get to you in a second, Charlie. I promise. Okay. First, let's just read, this is some of his first paragraphs. He says essentially as follows. Religious Judaism has no clear idea of the plan and the tangible and realistic meaning of the laws of Shabbat regarding the state and the dependent society of the people of Israel in the present. Says Yishai Leibowitz, we have no plan. There is no solution. What's happening right now is essentially allowing the problem to sort of ruminate. We have no way of actually functioning as society on Shabbat within the confines of halacha. And he says he blames the rabbis, right? As we say, they more religious Judaism refrain from any serious clarification of the problem. And then this is all my translation, by the way. And never brought before the state and the government and the people, not even before the religious public itself, any concrete plan of running the state and the economy on Shabbat according to the Torah within society and economy as they are and as Judaism religion itself participates in them. and has not even offered any other form of society and economy which is sustainable. We have a problem, we have no solution, and we're just sort of, you know, subsisting with the reality which is not acceptable. That's his claim here. And he says, what's the problem? And this is an important thing to consider. By doing so, religious Judaism removed from the war for Shabbat any educational public significance in any political public way. It does not appear as an effort, an active struggle for the realization of a particular and defined lifestyle plan, but as a passive routine stubbornness directed against society's ways and methods of satisfying public needs, without offering any alternative to these ways and methods. Essentially, what he's saying is as follows, right? What he's saying is, well, we have a problem on Shabbat. You go to the rabbis, the rabbis say, okay, I don't know. Let's get a Gentile to do it, right? Oh, you have a problem with police on Shabbat? I don't know. Maybe this is okay, but that's not okay. Oh, what about the economy? You know, oh, we need the water supply to run? The way at least he's presenting it, I don't know. Maybe we can't do that. What do we do then, Rabbi? I don't know. That's essentially his claim. He's saying, instead of saying, okay, Shabbat exists, the state exists, and here's what we need to do, and there's like a clearly defined plan, his Professor Leibowitz's claim is, we just sort of, you know, go from each case and shrug our shoulders and try to come up with some sort of band-aid where people look at us and they're thinking, you're not saying it's okay, and you're not giving us an alternative. That's his claim. And here's sort of the conclusion, which I think is beyond the confines of what I would call orthodox thinking, but this is what he says. This Sabbath, as embodied in the law that came to us and as embodied in the traditional way of sanctifying the holiness of generations, is the Sabbath of a person whose obligations as a citizen and his duties are not included in his life plan. The Sabbath of the public exempt from protection, external, internal security, government offices, foreign policy, holding an army and police, independent production to meet its needs, foreign trade within the framework of conditions set by international bodies. Sabbath, as handed down to us through the Talmud, Shulchan Aruch, and the like, claims Professor Leibowitz, is the Sabbath of a person who does not have to participate in society as a citizen of their own independent state. This form of Shabbat was formed against the background of the assumption of a certain historical reality, the lack of political independence and political functions for the people of Israel, and the lack of civic duties for a person from Israel in the real present. And this assumption became a necessary condition for the very possibility of the observance of this Sabbath. And he says, therefore, saving the Shabbat from the dangers, from the degeneration of parasitism, instead of parasitic sort of solutions, preventing the separation of the state and institutions from the Shabbat and acquiring the hearts of the public and youth for the Shabbat, all require a new approach based on halachic decisions and against the background of a new religious legislation. Chakicha datit chadasha is what he calls it. This legislation may lead to a marked deviation from the same religious practice and way of life that has been sanctified for generations in a world of a lack of political independence and civic responsibility. And nevertheless, it will be Torah law. Essentially, in two sentences, argues Professor Leibowitz, and again, I don't agree with this, but he says the problem is we're not addressing Shabbat, and all the little band-aids you want to put on this gashing wound aren't enough. Not enough. And the only way for Shabbat not to be separate from the government, not to be something that we can't handle, but to actually have a functioning state that can observe Shabbat is to consider a new form of Shabbat observance. The tradition we have until now was for the individual, and now we have a state. That is Professor Leibowitz's argument. Now, I imagine that most people in this audience will not be happy with that argument. Certainly am not. What about it bothers you specifically? I want to get to Charlie first because I cut him off before. Charlie, what do you got?
I just wanted to refer to the slide where you showed the 7 points. And his last point, you said that must be his strongest point.
Strongest in the sense most controversial.
Number number seven, right? During the temple times, I mean, they were sacrificing animals on Shabbos.
That's true.
They were putting fires on, and they were cleaning, and they were doing everything they had to do.
That's true.
In the temple, right?
That's right.
Okay, so.
Yes, now, that's the question. So
there's no question, really, but to your last slides, why can't you have an individual following one way and the state following something different?
Well, the question is, what is it following? What halacha is the state going to follow? Now, to number seven, I think there's an easy response, isn't there? Okay, so he's arguing that malacha was allowed in the temple. That's true. There's no doubt about that. And so what?
So
you're going to say, if it's allowed in the temple, therefore it's also allowed in the state? Is that the argument? Because I just don't know if that follows.
No, but since then we have all the malachas of Shabbos that were brought in, and we have to observe. They weren't always that specific in biblical times.
Okay, but so let me say it this way: that Sabbath as a creation is allowed to offer sacrifices and the like is not something that comes from a system of tradition in Torah Shabbal Peh, whereby the rabbis learn from the fact that Torah says you can offer sacrifices on Shabbat, that temple service overrides Shabbat, right? That's and we can ask why that is an interesting question, but it doesn't come from nowhere. To simply argue that, look, we have now, he makes the following arguments. We do have places in halacha where there is a difference between a tzibor, a congregation, a yachin. One example is the laws of purity and impurity. So for instance, if the entire congregation is impure, we can enter the temple and give sacrifices, because we say tamahacha betzibor, impurity is all permissible for the congregation. You do have a general idea that the halacha is different for a tzibor than a yachid, but that does not necessarily follow, therefore, that the mailman can drive on Shabbos and deliver your mail to your door, because, okay, apparently we can just waive the laws of Shabbos for the state. You can't just extend a specific permit for malacha from the temple to all things necessary for the state unless you have what Paul said before, precedent. Halacha is a system, right? It's not, okay, you know, there's a problem, so let's just say, well, I think this is kind of similar, and maybe it's a similar solution. That's essentially, I mean, I'm sure other people have issues as well, but I think that he identifies a number of problems. Now, we can quibble with some of them for sure. Number one, you know, all of these things are not arbitrary. Relying on a Gentile, if it's a legitimate dispensation, we can rely on a Gentile. There are times in halacha where you're allowed to ask a non-Jew to do things for you, right? You know, or the notion of deviation, shinuyim, that's a legitimate halachic process. So, but the point I'd like to make, and I think the main objection here is halacha isn't arbitrary. It's a system, and it can adapt to situations, but you need to take part in that system. To simply say the law as we have it just doesn't cut it, let's make a new law, that's not how halacha works. You can't just make that decision. We have to look at each individual problem and think about the issues at hand and think about what halacha says about those issues. That's how halachic Judaism generally works. It doesn't work by saying, uh-oh, we got a problem here. Let's just make a new halacha, right? That's what I meant, Charlie, by sourcing line number seven, but I think being the most problematic. You can't just make up a permissibility for a state unless you had precedent and a source from the tradition for doing that. You have to go back to tradition.
Does Leibowitz attempt to flesh out a solution?
Here's the solution. Let's hereby declare, we all got together and says, look, it must be that Shabbos desecration is allowed on behalf of the basic functions of a state. That's the solution. That's a general framework. And now we can go about, you know, with the specifics. That's a solution. He has a general precedent, okay, in the temple, certain things were allowed. There's a general preference for a tzibor over a yachid, but that he has no clear precedent or source for any of this. No.
So as a rabbi, he's going contrary to what you said.
He's not a rabbi. He is a professor.
He's hiding on
one, a philosopher also. It's not like he has very specific views about halacha and God and Judaism. You could read a lot about Yishai Leibowitz. He's a very controversial thinker, and you see sort of, let me put it this way. I think he's identified the problem very well. It is challenging. It's challenging to say to an entire state, we can't really function on the Sabbath, but we can rely on certain, mitigating factors that make it less stringent. The problem of, what do we do about Shabbat is, it just doesn't, we have no real solutions. We just have to patch up problems here and there. Isn't very compelling. He makes a good point. So he identified the problem well. His solution is a lack of a solution, though. It's not a solution. We don't just make up halacha and say, okay, we have a problem. It must be that it's allowed. So what other avenue do we have? So let's take a look at Moshe Neriah's response. And what I'd like to do is show you, there's two general approaches I'd like to suggest. Number one is that, instead of just waving the white flag, what we can do is be creative in our thinking and look at precedent from various established areas of halacha and consider how they might apply to a state that we can think about pikuach nefesh, which is clear in halacha, that in situations in which it involves saving lives, then we do violate Shabbat. And then we can think of, what does it mean to save lives on a national level? And what might not be considered saving lives for an individual may be considered saving lives for the general public. So that's not, avenue one is we can use the precedent to establish new halachot. And then there's the other question of how we look at things like relying on Gentiles and shinuyim, and why deviations of the normal way of doing things and why we do them. And it's not just like, okay, we can't really allow it, but if you, twiddle your thumbs a little bit, it makes it okay. No, there's a reason for that dispensation.
Rabbi,
so let's take a look.
Rabbi, just about the word precedent, okay?
Okay.
I don't really see how there could be even a precedent, because once the state was never a state, the state became a state in 1948.
Let's see.
You can't go before 48. You can't go prior to 48 to look for precedents, because there was no state.
Because let me respond as follows to that, okay? Let me respond as follows. Is that necessarily true that if you don't have the exact same situation, that means there's no precedent?
No, the British ruled like we live in a country here where not a ruler, but
what I'm asking is as follows. They didn't invent cars when the Talmud was written, right? There was no car invented in Babylon, but that doesn't mean halacha has no way of dealing with the phenomenon of the invention of a car.
But we're talking about a state here.
Okay, so we have to find the best bases of comparison that we had. So take a look at, hold on for a second. I want to hear what you think after we go through some of the thinking here. So here's the Ravinarius basic argument, as summarized by Rosen. Basic 6 points. Number one, he's essentially saying, especially with regards to a reformist approach, that means corrections in religion. He's basically, the argument, it's pretty strong. He's saying, that's not orthodoxy. What you're basically saying is religion as we have it ain't good enough. We need to change it. That's not an orthodox way of thinking. I think that's a pretty basic point that we can contend from Professor Leibowitz. Otherwise, though, number two, it is impossible to find workable solutions when those in charge in the field are not Sabbath keepers. Meaning, this is sort of a defense of the rabbinate. You're blaming the rabbinate for not finding a workable solution for the state. But let's be honest, the people who run the state aren't currently Sabbath observant. So you can't really work with them in terms of halacha. It's hard to come up with solutions, and I'll explain what he means. Number three, and here's a very fundamental point. Our Torah is a Torah of life and has an answer for all generations through the test cases spoken about by sages of the Torah. This is basic halacha, and it's certainly in medical halacha, if you study that, where what poskim do is they look for interesting cases in the halacha or in the Gemara, which are sort of exceptional for the time, but that can be used as a basis for the reality that we live in. It's called their principles. We apply principles. Even if the specific example isn't the same, it's the application of principles that allows halacha to evolve. Number four, Rabbi Professor Leibowitz waves his flag and says, technology ain't going to cut it. Well, technology can actually be very helpful. We have come to many technological solutions. Automation and things of that nature do significantly help in reducing some of these problems. And number five and number six, which I like to relying on Gentiles and deviations, that those are part of halacha too. Why are you frowning upon asking Gentiles to do certain things or, you know, changing from a normal way of performing a malacha in order to do something? Those are part of the system. So let's take a look at some of his words here. He argues essentially that in order to get in the mind of a posek, a rabbi, a big gadol hador, right? Let's try to put on our posek hat for a second. Imagine you're the chief rabbi of Israel for a second, okay? And someone comes to you with one of these issues. How are we going to operate our homeland security on Shabbat? Or specifically, this is the realm of, let's say the realm of diplomacy, that there's certain, you know, items in the news that we need to know about as a government. And so we need to look at the news, or we need to call people, or we need to engage in, you know, communication with other countries on Shabbat. So how would you go about figuring out, determining whether or not that is permissible? He argues there's two steps. Number one, we have to figure out which actions are essential. What of what you want to do as the security department or as a police force, what of the things that a police force does, which of those activities are essential? And number two, once we identify that, the faithful execution of the foundations of halacha, that every act will be done in accordance with the rabbi and its instructions and according to its exact terms. Essentially, the point is, once something becomes essential for the security of the state, it's allowed on Shabbat. So that becomes a tricky question. What police activity, for instance, is allowed on Shabbat? Clearly, stopping a murder is allowed. What about stopping a robbery? Well, that might be allowed too. What about speeding tickets? What about, you know, traffic control? What about general patrolling? So that we have to define whether what's essential and what's not. Once it's essential, it's allowed. There's no need to say we don't know what to do. It is allowed. And then the question is, if it's allowed, how do we go about doing it in the most appropriate way? And he argues, if the government aspired to build the state on the foundations of the Torah and the mitzvah, there would be no difficulty in observing it without violating the laws of Shabbat. Yes. And he gives an example, right? He says an example of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Diplomacy. He says, some things are essential. There's some things that the government just needs to know. They're absolutely essential, right? Whether it be, you know, news within some of the countries that surround Israel that might be a threat. But there are some essential items. There are also essential things that are just routine news and announcements that have no urgency whatsoever. And that you shouldn't allow the breaking of Shabbat for their sake, right? I think we can all argue this is true. And then there's going to be a gray area, which requires, is this essential? Is it not? Do we need to notice now? Do we not? It's not always so clear. And for that, we have Torah scholars who, based on their knowledge of the situation told to them by the government and their knowledge of halacha, can make a decision as to whether or not the gray area qualifies as essential or not. But now it's worth taking, you know, the difference between Professor Leibowitz's approach and Rabbi Nariah's approach, right? Whereas Professor Leibowitz is saying, look, a government needs the Department of Foreign Affairs. So it's all allowed. That's it. Because foreign affairs allowed in Shabbat because that's the way the state works. That's going to allow a lot of things that are certainly not essential. You know, it's an easy solution, but it's lazy. It's not thorough, rigorous thinking. And here's what he says should happen. If a Torah observant Jew had a foreign ministry, he would send a strict instruction to all foreign intelligence sources that the ministry's intelligence services should not be used on Saturdays except for the most essential cases. That should be the policy. And then any religious Jew would be allowed to work in the foreign ministry's intelligence services without any doubt. Let me compare it to an individual, right? We all know that there are certain doctors who work on Shabbat, right? So, and we all know that there are certain things done in the hospital that are permissible on Shabbat. You can, you know, do a life-saving surgery, right? You can deliver a baby on Shabbat. All those are allowed. And then there are certainly things that are not allowed on Shabbat, right? You know, which are just not necessary, but are generally done because that's the way that you do it when you're a doctor. And then there's a gray area, something like, you know, I'm not going to get into this now, but writing a note on Shabbat. Does the note need to be written now? Okay, so that can be a complicated question. If it does need to be written, how should we write the note? So there's gray area, and that's what you need to know when you go into the hospital on Shabbat as a doctor, right? And that he's saying it's the same thing, as is, however, that's not the case. Because everything runs like a weekday, because the way he says the foreign ministry now runs is that, okay, we just treat it like a normal day. And that isn't a sufficient halachic solution. Okay. Now, here is a very basic attack on the notion of making changes, right? And his comment is as follows. Professor Leibowitz sits and demands like Moses from the mouth of God, right? Here he thinks he's Moses. And rules that all these questions cannot be solved by seeking permits, even if these permits are halachically kosher. In his opinion, the services and public works that it is a mitzvah to perform on Shabbat do not need to make changes with the permit. That's why I decided. I personally would have decided that you don't need to make changes. You can function normally and stay on Shabbat because that's what is necessary. But like, why? And why don't you need to make the deviations? This is a really interesting point. The notion of making a change on Shabbat. Why do we do that, right? So going back to our individual in the hospital, say you're a doctor and you need to write a note, right? So there's a difference between writing it with your hands in a pencil or writing it with a computer, which is not quite as strict. Why do we bother with that? Why don't we just say, write the note, it's necessary. It's, you know, pikuach nefesh, it's life-saving. Why don't we ask people to mitigate the prohibition? What do you think? And he says it here. Why is that? Why do we ask people sometimes to make a shinoi? Why do we say, for instance, if a person is sick on Shabbat in certain circumstances, but it's not life-threatening, but they're sick in bed, you can ask a Gentile to get medicine for you, potentially. That is the halacha. Because you can do a derabbanan or rabbinic prohibition to save someone who's sick on Shabbat, even if it's not life-threatening. If it's a rabbinic prohibition, why? Why don't we just say you do it yourself? What's the reason for that? The reason is because even when we need to violate Shabbat, we still want to observe the general notion of Shabbat as much as possible. That violating Shabbat, we want to send a message that that's not an easy thing for us. So we allow certain things by making deviations that allows halacha on the one hand to be flexible enough to adapt to certain situations which require Shabbos desecration, while at the same time maintaining a semblance of Shabbat. So when I type on my computer on the note or whatever it is I do, and I open the door with my elbow instead of using my hand, what am I doing? I'm saying this requires breaking Shabbat, but I'm not throwing it away completely. That's actually not the craziest thing. It's actually quite valuable. So here, Professor Leibowitz is saying, oh, that doesn't make any sense. We just should allow it because it doesn't feel right. No, the mechanisms that halacha allows in terms of making these sort of deviations actually allow halacha certain flexibility.
I'd like to know if Professor Leibowitz was a Talmud Chacham.
He was.
He was. No, okay. No, he knew all the background and
yeah, it's not a question of knowing specifics. It's a question of your philosophy about that. Professor Leibowitz knows about the fact that you can change the way you do something and limit or mitigate how serious a Shabbat violation it is. He knows that. But he looks at that as like, oh, that's just an excuse. Like, whatever, that's the rabbi saying something, but that's not good enough on a statewide level. Where Professor Rabbi Neri says, what do you mean? Like, that's a halachic mechanism. So then why are you just saying it's not good enough and saying we should just allow it completely? You're just throwing Shabbat out the window instead of trying to mitigate the prohibition. That's the sort of the back and forth on that. So now, in this regard, though, I want to, and Rabbi Rosen quotes a number of specific examples of creative thinking in terms of providing these halachic solutions. So let's go through a few of them. And I think they'll, again, this is not all of them. These problems continue to this day, obviously. We're still thinking of different ways to solve some of these. But Zionist rabbis, at the beginning of the founding of the State of Israel, came up with a new way to think of halacha. But when they did that, it wasn't just, you know, they didn't throw away everything. I'm just going to mute everyone just for a second. It wasn't simply, you know, we're going to throw it all away. It also wasn't that we'll just have to do what we always did. It's called creativity, halakha creativity, creative ways of applying precedence to a new reality. That's also a religious Zionist endeavor. That's what I'd like to argue here. So here we have a really interesting halakha based on the Gemara and Aaron. This is a very well-known halakha. It relates to the sugya of driving to the hospital on Shabbat and driving back. It actually, as we'll see, relates to some of the halachot that came in regard to the pandemic. But this is the Gemara in Erevin, and this relates to your point, Paul, because this is not the first time we had to defend ourselves from our enemies. Jews have always had enemies and lived in towns and been attacked before, right? So here the Gemara deals with the situation of a community defending themselves from Gentiles who are attacking them. And what do you do about that on Shabbat? So let me just skip to the middle paragraph. The Gemara starts off in A with the first little snippet there with a fascinating halacha, which is that if Gentiles are attacking or besieging a Jewish town, then it depends whether or not you can violate Shabbat, carry your weapons to defend yourself, depends on their motivation. And that's the middle paragraph. This was also taught in a braita with a caveat. With regard to Gentiles who besieged in what, you know, and wanted to fight against a town, in what case is this said? It is said in a case where the Gentiles came and besieged a town with regard to monetary matters. So point, if they're just there for your money, objectively, you should not violate Shabbat. However, if they came with regard to lives, i.e., there is concern the Gentiles will attack, they may go out against them with their weapons, and they may desecrate Shabbat due to them. So if it's a matter of life and death, you can violate Shabbat to fight against them. If it's not a matter of life and death, but it's just money, then you cannot. And then the Gemara continues. And with regard to a town that is located near the border, and this is the William Davidson translation, even if the Gentiles did not come with regard to lives, but rather with regard to matters of hay and straw, meaning to raid the town, but not to kill, they may go out and against them with their weapons, and they may desecrate Shabbat. If they're attacking a border town, a town on the border, then no matter what their aim is, you can defend the town on the border. Why do you think the town on the border is different? Well, might you argue? What's special about a town on the border? It's a greater security risk, right?
But Rabbi, with respect, it's not ludicrous. What are you going to do? Someone's attacking your town. You're going to say, oh, before you attack the town, can you tell me why you're attacking the town? Are you just for my money?
If you don't know, obviously, this is assuming you know. If you think
that's a ludicrous it is. If someone's attacking your town, you defend it.
I don't think the Gemara is necessarily against what you're saying. And just hold on for a second. We'll see. I hear you. And we'll just wait for a second. It's the way that Gemara works, it does have ludicrous examples, because you're right, you probably aren't going to generally know. But we model the principle. The principle that Gemara is saying is, just if it's you're just stealing from you, you can't violate Shabbat to save the money. But hold on a second, okay? That's the Gemara. Then we get to the Shulchan Aruch, okay? Which writes as follows. Regarding non-Jews who besiege Jewish cities, if they come for money, we do not desecrate the Shabbat. But if they came to kill or come with no presented reason, and that's you, Paul, they don't tell us why they're there. Meaning, if they come and say, give us all your money, That's one thing. If they come and say, we're going to kill you all, that's another thing. If they come and they don't tell us why they're coming, then you defend yourself. We go out with weapons to desecrate the Shabbat. In a city that is near the border, even if they just come for straw or hay, we desecrate the Shabbat. And Ramah says, even if they haven't come, but they want to come, even if they're not there, but you know that they're going to come, you can anticipate their arrival. You don't have to wait for them to come to the border. Now, Mighty Malvi CU, that's actually quite an extension. Because you could say, well, how do you know that you, it's right to develop violate Shabbat? But Ramah says, no, you don't need to wait for them to attack you. You can preemptively go to defend yourself. And I'll add one more thing, which came out very recently in terms of the pandemic. This is the mugging of Ram. And then he adds as follows. There is one who says that in our times, and this is for you, Paul, again, even if they come for money, we desecrate the Shabbat. Even if they tell us we want all your money, we still violate Shabbat to defend ourselves. Because if we do not allow them to plunder the money, they will kill. And so it becomes a case of saving lives. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says here. Since if we try to defend ourselves from stealing the money, which obviously might happen, then it will come to actual life and death. Therefore, before that happens, we preemptively defend ourselves, even if they say they want our money and they're not after our lives, right? And the Magen Avraham says something fascinating here, which was relevant very recently, where he says, what do you mean? Didn't you just say, what do you mean? And if we defend ourselves, we should just hand them our money if it means violating Shabbat. He says, no, because people aren't going to do that. Because one person is going to say, I'm not giving up my money. I'm going to defend myself. And for that one person who may defend themselves, we all violate Shabbat. That's the Magen Avraham says. For one person who is going to say, you know what, I'm not standing by and letting these people take my money. You know, I'm gonna fight them. Because that's going to happen, the whole community defends themselves against the besieging army. This related, and many of people, Rabbi Tversky from Yeshiva University, apply this to the situation, 18 months ago, in a case where people were saying, what about, why don't we have minyanim, where everybody's going to be careful. We're all going to social distance. Where at the time, the argument was, but even if you're all saying that, but you know what's going to happen? Two people are not going to social distance. And then they're going to get sick. So for those two people, it's worth the argue canceling the whole minyan. That was his argument at the time, based on this precedent. So what we have here is we do have some precedent for halacha in terms of defending ourselves from attacking armies. That does exist in halacha. And then Rabbi Gorin extends it to a state. What is considered a city on the border in the state of Israel? So you're going to say, well, just the ones on the border. Well, that's not so clear. So first of all, he writes as follows. We learn that any infiltration for the purpose of stealing property, especially since it is directed primarily against the settlements of the border, it is permissible to fight against it on Shabbat. There is no difference between when the ambush is carried out or near the border. Essentially, infiltration generally, any infiltration by enemies is already life-threatening. Because what do we learn? If it's on the border, if it will allow the enemy to gain an important position which will compromise the country's security, and even for a monetary matter, you can violate Shabbat to protect yourselves. In addition, we can prove that today every settlement in the country is judged as a border settlement. Why? There are also minorities sitting within the state, and most of them are hostile to the state, and therefore every settlement should be discussed as sitting on the border. So what Rabbi Gorin essentially argues, based on this notion that any attack on the border city from in the Talmud is considered a life-threatening situation, he argues any attack from an enemy on Shabbat is going to allow Shabbos desecration in order to defend it because of the situation on the ground that necessitates a life-threatening situation and allows Shabbos desecration. So here we took a Gemara and we applied it and we expanded its application from the literal translation of the Gemara to the current day situation. Now, ultimately, is this similar to what Professor Leibowitz says? It is kind of similar in terms of scope, because we are ultimately saying we're allowed to defend ourselves. But rather than simply saying, okay, halacha doesn't function, we look for a precedent from halacha and look to apply it to the current situation. Another really interesting thing from Rabbi Gorin. He quotes here from the Gemara in Shabbat. I believe it's 19a. I forgot the source here. The Gemara here has a unique thing. It says you don't ideally besiege a country, a town, and this is an aggressive attack. You shouldn't attack a neighboring town less than 3 days before Shabbat. But if you already began the attack, if you already engage in a skirmish with another country for military purposes, then you continue even into Shabbat. Here's what's interesting. The quote is ad ridita, until it falls. It's a quote from a pasuk in Deuteronomy. What's interesting about this is the general source for allowing the violation of Shabbat to save lives is from v'chai b'hem b'lo sheyamot b'hem, that you shall live by them and not die by them. Says Rabbi Gorin, this is not your average allowance for Shabbat desecration to save lives. This is a unique dispensation specifically for military purposes. It's a unique pasuk. It's ad ridita. You're allowed to siege the nation until it falls, even if that runs into Shabbat. And therefore, he argues, from all this, an important principle emerges that the permit for fighting on Shabbat is not based on a permit for the saving of lives, as one is accustomed to think, but on a special permit intended solely for combat. His argument is we have a broader permit for military purposes than for normal life-saving exercises based on a unique verse quoted in the Gemara. So here, again, we have a halachic solution based on a Talmudic source that is based in our tradition, which allows for a broader area for the army to operate in our current day. That's the line of thinking. So instead of simply waving the flag and saying, look, we're stuck, there's nothing we could do, let's just say the state is allowed to function on Shabbat, Rabbi Gorin looks to halachic precedents to allow, to consider how we may think about these problems in our day and age. Another brief example, and then we'll get to our conclusion. So here I have a quote from Yisrael Yisraeli, also a very, we've commented on before, and some of the previous year, I'm a very prominent religious Zionist post-age. And he here is extending the notion of pikuach nefesh. And his argument essentially is as follows. Pikuach nefesh, life-saving activities for an individual, differs for life-saving activities for a state. Because when it comes to an individual, you know, the bar might be very high. But if it comes to a state, what might not be threatening to you on a national level, if everybody in the state is exposed to a certain situation, it might eventually come to the saving of lives. So for instance, he writes here, the livelihood of the individual, for example, has no impact on the saving of lives. But if the public is lacking in livelihood and making a living in an economy, even if it does not concern bread, even if it's not, I'm going to die of starvation if we don't do this, it's not impossible that in one of many, there will be one that needs better food for which it can be the saving of lives. That maybe, you know, let's just, like, if you look at a specific industry and we say we're not going to have that industry on Shabbat, why? Because no one's going to starve. Well, maybe not. Maybe if you don't have that industry in your entire country, one person may starve. Or it will lead to a situation in which someone will die. You know, that the decisions of governments are always life and death. How you decide to give out money ultimately does result in one person living and another person dying. So on a national level, there's a different way of looking at pikuach nefesh. That, I think, is part of the challenge of religious Zionism. It's taking the halachic principles that we have that are part of our tradition and considering how they may apply to a new situation of a state. And here, Israel Rosen writes as follows. Essentially, his argument is that as the religious Zionist outlook is that our Torah is a Torah Chayim. It's a living Torah. It's never exile. It's not that, okay, it has to only apply outside a state. No, that the halakha has ways of functioning And generally, what we've done, we've had different permits, you know, general terrain, and we've also used certain side avenues, the use of Gentiles, deviations, and loopholes. And instead of saying like Professor Leibowitz, where we say, no, that's sufficient, I don't like loopholes, I don't like using any of those, let's just say the whole thing's permissible, rabbis have said, no, we're going to use the mechanisms halacha allows us to use. And he writes as follows, as the founder of Tzomet, Machon Tzomet, his argument is, and I, the small ad, following a personal life enterprise at the Tzomet Institute, I believe strongly that modern technology is capable of solving a very significant part of state and public problems. But there is a great condition in this matter, that observant Jews be found in all spheres of life and staff most vital sectors. They must be imbued with the consciousness of the need to consult with distinct collective personalities with the Zionist religious worldview. That in order for part of the religious Zionist outlook is we need to be involved in all matters of state and government and all the different industries so that we can think together about creative solutions to the interface of halacha and technology and modernity in our tradition. And that's part of being found, part of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is thinking in creative ways to solve these sorts of problems. And so now that we're coming to the end of the series, let me end with the following thought as we sort of approach Tisha B'Av. We started with sort of the idealism of Rav Kook, right? Rav Kook, who's thinking that, you know, all the wonderful things about a Jewish state and, you know, and of expressing Jewish values in a Torah Yisrael in the land of Israel and all that idealism and that's all so important. But I think the place of religious Zionism is in that area between the ideal and the practical. And that we start with these ideals of wanting as best as we can to participate in the redemptive process, in bringing Israel back to its land, in having a functioning state based on Torah values. That's what we all pray for. We mourn for the fact that we don't have it in its fullness. We don't get to observe these things the way we want to. But the idealism isn't the end all and be all. It ends up in the practical, that that idealism inspires us to think of practical solutions on the ground. And the fact that this current state of Israel isn't that ideal that Rav Kook imagined doesn't relieve us from our responsibility to engage with it and use our ideals and our tradition to make it the best state of Israel that it can be. And there need to be compromises and creative solutions and dealing with very difficult problems. But that's essentially what I believe it means to be a religious Zionist, to have all those ideals in mind and all that passion, and then to go back into the real concrete world and think of a way to deal with it. And so as we approach Tisha B'Av and the mourning of our temple and our exile, it's worth appreciating the challenges and the difficulties and the fact that we are lacking a lot of the ideal that we aspire to, but at the same time appreciating what we do have and praying that it continue to develop and improve and there could be more peace and more reconciliation and more creative solutions so that the state of Israel can be a true embodiment of the Jewish people and the Torah and our values. Thank you all of you who listened in to this class. It was really enjoyable learning with you. And may we see the temple speedily rebuilt in our days.
Shkoyach.